Hello and welcome to Brussels Unplugged. Matteo, we're finally back from the holidays.
Happy New Year, Pietro.
Happy welcome New Year. Back. Thank you. Just got off the jet lag. Still not used to the cold again. I'm freezing my butt off. Matteo, how's it been for you to be back?
Again, likewise. I also didn't have a really great comeback. I've been freezing. I've been cold. I had the flu, but let's not talk about that.
No. Let's not.
It's been a bit traumatic, let's say.
Understandably. A little bit post-holiday trauma. But today we have somebody here who spends a lot of time outside of Brussels. That she does live here, Sabina Chofu, the associate director from Tech UK. So, Sabina, were you somewhere warm? Let's start with that. Tell us a little bit about yourself as well.
Unfortunately, not somewhere terribly warm, but back home in Romania for a couple of weeks, where I just slept. Slept through 2 weeks, didn't know which day I was waking up on, what day of the week it was, what day of the month of December it was, and it was phenomenal. Just what I needed. Visited my grandma in my hometown in northeast Romania, which is the border with, those of you not very good at geography.
I'm half American, so please.
Close to the border with Moldova and Ukraine, and I don't know anyone there anymore except for my grandmother, so there is absolutely no social life for 10 days, which was very sweet. Just what I needed. So I was just emerging from my cave when I was hungry and roaming the kitchen for food, and that was exactly what was needed after a crazy year. So I can't say batteries have been recharged, but here we are.
Back to social life in Brussels.
Back to everything. It just feels like it's been 3 months of 2025 already, and I can't believe it's only been 2 weeks.
So what's your take? And was it you? If you have to summarize a bit your career and what you do in Brussels, how do you define yourself? What do you say?
I can't do the definitions. I'm always really bad with definitions because I don't fit probably in any of your classical boxes, if you want, for what you're supposed to do or how you're supposed to follow a career path. So what I did, so I'm born in northeast Romania, as I said, a year before the revolutions that brought down the Berlin Wall and with them the communist regimes in Eastern Europe. Thankfully. So very lucky to have been raised in democracy, frail and complicated one at times, but still democracy. I went to university in the UK the same year my country joined the European Union, and when the UK was still a member of the European Union. So very convenient, as that was literally the only time I could have afforded to study in the UK. It's always been like I'm a big beneficiary of the series of events that just happened in Europe and the people who made them happen. And it's a massive privilege to be able to kind of experience the world as I do compared to, you know, only recently my parents for that matter. Studied in the UK. I studied classics, so not your usual degree for starting a career in European policy. For those of you who wonder what on earth that is, a Latin and ancient Greek about 3 years of my life. it was quite an experience, and I studied those two languages in English in the UK, so basically in a foreign language for me as well. And then I decided I want to change the world. I kind of decided that throughout uni as I got involved in all kinds of debate societies and model European Union, model United Nations and all kinds of things like that, that I wanted to kind of make a contribution to the world. And I thought, where better to do it than the center of the universe or maybe the European Union. Came to Brussels to do that. So started, like everyone else, with an unpaid internship for about 6 months, trying to make sense of how you actually work 5 days a week and get no money at the end of it. Been working in the European Parliament for about 9 years. Moved on to work for the UK tech sector for the last six. So not your traditional career path, I would say. Also, I did a master's at some point in absolutely useless, probably the most useless studies I've ever done, 2012 to 2014, War in the Modern World.
you regret that master? or not?
I don't. I'll tell you why it was completely useless. So at King's College London, absolutely phenomenal program, phenomenal university. Problem is, like, I spent 2 years talking about how we'll never have conventional war again. So.
Oh wow, that's out the window.
I think history proved you right? Yeah.
It was all about, you know, everything will be cyber and, you know, everything will be technological warfare and there will be absolutely no tanks rolling into other countries ever again.
And here we are.
And here we are.
Close to the third anniversary of war in Ukraine.
In Ukraine, exactly. So yeah. Absolutely.
Well, that's interesting. The tech side is very interesting, as much as the Parliament career path, which is something very common to many people. But before we went on record, you were talking about how you are in Brussels, but not much in Brussels.
Yeah, I have a global role now for Tech UK. So I cover all our core markets, EU being very much the first one, but also the US, Asia Pacific, Middle East. As kind of most important markets for us. So I spend a lot of time on a plane, so my sustainability footprint is not fantastic at the moment. But I do, you know, and we also kind of cover all the international organizations as well, so everything around the G7 and, you know, all the things that are not very popular right now, like multilateral cooperation, that's what I do, yeah.
It's gonna be a tough season ahead, let's say, for that one.
I mean, it's been tough for quite some time. I was reflecting on that recently because when I joined Tech UK, we have 1,100 members, so we have a lot of members. There are probably around 150 companies that were like, okay, what else is going on in the world that we should be aware of? mostly covering, you know, either Brussels or European affairs or thinking about the US or, you know, but broadly in very cooperative terms at the time. And I'll probably have something like 550 members involved in my work. And that was a big consequence after the war in Ukraine. So after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, when we had all this like packages of sanctions and rules coming up overnight, when basically a lot of companies were like, well, what else is happening in the world that we should maybe be aware of? you know, I think it's fair to say it's only been downhill from there. So, in terms of global cooperation, technology.
Has Brexit in any way, I mean, in which way? Of course, it has impacted probably your work, but in which way? And now that we're almost, 5 years since they left, the process started much earlier, but have you seen an evolution or a progress?
We are definitely in a much better place. You know, having worked here for the very dark days of Brexit, I think it's fair to say, you know, the improvement is very obvious. I mean, you know, in the very early days, I remember I was asking for meeting requests with the Commission and we were saying, Sabina, it's not personal, but neither I nor anyone in my team is going to speak to you. Okay. So it was a very interesting time. I mean, you know, tense and very complicated to have even basic conversations around cooperation because, you know, like any divorce is not a happy time. I think it's been definitely improving even before the U.S. election the U.K. election and the EU elections. It's been improving considerably as the previous government and the Prime Minister Sunak was very much focused on getting some of the things over the line, including Horizon and a financial services agreement and some other things. The new government in the UK is, I hope people have heard, very keen on a reset with the EU.
Yes, we heard.
So hopefully we'll be able to have a much closer relationship as we should because, there's just so much alignment of values and views of the world that we should be working closer together.
Absolutely. It's definitely looking rosier than during the Brexit times. But how much of an impact will the lack of growth in the UK play and, let's say, the appetite to get for rapprochement?
Well, I think in a way, if you look across the G7 economies, maybe with the exception of the US right now, You know, stagnation is a problem kind of across the board. You know, demographic issues are a problem across the board. We have a lot of elderly population, and not enough children, and not enough young people to support the economies. Productivity is a problem across the board. So I think there is, if anything, I don't think it's necessarily a UK problem, or you know, Germany has that problem. Mm-hmm. France has that problem.
Oh, we're Italian. You're going to talk about aging.
Italy did better for a while, so we'll see. But Japan definitely has that problem. Yeah. So I think we are sharing it across the board. And if anything, you know, the situation we're all in should, in principle, kind of get people closer together and get people to a negotiating table and try to kind of find ways to work closer together to drive that growth and productivity back into the economy. So, yeah, I think if anything, it should be a matter of closer cooperation, not moving further away from each other and doing our own thing, because that has historically not worked.
Sabina, I wanted to take you back to Brussels a bit, because I know that you're involved in several organizations. Before we went on the record, we were just discussing that we met in one of the meetings of Restless Brussels, which is an organization that has been canvassing, advocating for registering expat to vote at the local elections. You have parties, as I said, other organizations. Can you tell us a bit about this, about your involvement in this active citizenship here?
Yeah, sometimes people living in Brussels, they always get a bit itchy when you kind of talk about how rainy and horrible it is. And it's like, oh my God, Brussels is beautiful. I'm like, yeah, it is. I've lived here for 15 years. It's also very grey and rainy. And what makes it particularly livable in, I think, is the quality of the communities we're part of. I've always believed in that. I've always kind of been involved in kind of setting up and running and communities that I thought were meaningful beyond just like professional networks, because I think there's a professional network for everything. I've been keen on building communities that kind of relate to on kind of some deeper values and kind of connect people on some deeper level than just, you know, we all work in security policy or energy policy or whatever that is. So Restless Brussels has been absolutely incredible. I've always kind of enjoyed this kind of civic kind of rising up the civic spirit in people, especially young people. I've done quite a few different projects in that space around European elections over the years and kind of getting more young people to vote. I think especially as we were looking at, I think 2019 was particularly bad for, you know, it was like, oh, it's the rise of populism and we kind of need to get more young people to the polls, and did a lot of work there at that point of the Global Shapers community of the World Economic Forum. Last year got involved with Tom Moylan's Restless Brussels and the community there, and try to get quite interesting conversations going over the street and be like, you know, are you registered to vote in Brussels? And they'd be like, I'm French, I don't care. I'm like,
oh, okay. But then everybody complains of the state of the city. But so few people vote in the local elections, especially among expats.
I agree with that. I've always said, like, you have a right to complain if you vote. If you don't vote, then, you know, I don't want to hear all the things you hate about the city you live in. It's true. But there is a lot of like just lack of knowledge around the around the Belgian local elections. So, you know, that's why the campaign was so good, because it was about kind of taking apart some of those myths about, you know, if you vote here, you'll never be allowed to vote in your country again, or things like that people are very sensitive about, especially given where politics across Europe are going. People are very keen to still be able to vote in their country, so they thought that this was taking something away from them. So we've done that. But then, you know, it's things like, you know, the young professionals in digital policy that, you know, we set up 10 years ago, and we're like 20 people in a bar, and now it's 700 people.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, and, you know, various other things. You know, I'm setting up the old professionals in digital policy.
That's when you grow up, then the upgrade.
Various people have been offended by the name, but as a 36-year-old, you know.
It's not young anymore. Well, I think we can all relate to that, at least the people in this room. That's very, very interesting. Do you do something else? Like, I checked a bit your profiles on LinkedIn. I see that you run a marathon. That's so great. I have so much admiration for
that's my
run a marathon.
It's my recipe for staying sane. Basically, the marathon running is a consequence of the pandemic. There is a decision at some point that either I go mad or I run. a lot, and I kind of decided to run a lot. I'm not sure those two options are very different to each other. But yeah, so I started running for a potential marathon in the pandemic, because there was no, everything was cancelled, everything was up in the air, so there is no clarity on whether or when a marathon will happen again. So I was training for about 4 months for a hypothetical marathon, and then Amsterdam got confirmed in 2021 in the autumn, and I registered for that one, and that's how I ran my first marathon. And I thought, I'm going to do one, you know, just do one marathon in the lifetime. And then a week later, I registered for Paris, and then, yeah, it's got a bug.
So how many have you done before?
I've done three, so not that many, but, you know, I'm still, I don't think I'm done yet. Every time I do one, I think I've done, because it's a completely crazy distance, but
it is.
Not yet.
It is. Well, people say that the last 10, after the 30th kilometers is like when you just have to go with your heart.
It's quite funny, because I was asking my runner friends before I did my first marathon, I'm like, okay, what happens? Everyone give me tips. And they're like, well, at some point you hit the wall. And it's exactly that, right? As you're saying, like last 10 kilometers, at some point you hit the wall. I'm like, what does it mean? And how do I deal with it? And they're like, oh, it's different for everyone. You know, some people have hallucinations. Some people have blackouts. Some people, you know, I'm like, this is really not helping.
Really,
you know, I need to know what happens and a recipe for how to deal with it. This is not helping. But it's true. Like, hitting the wall has been a very different experience in each of the marathons I've run. You know, sometimes it involves tears. Sometimes it involves complete loss of memory. Depends.
you have finished the marathon.
I finished all the three of them.
So.
Yes.
Wow. No, I've never ran a marathon. Most I've done is a 5K JP Morgan in Frankfurt.
Don't you feel motivated now to try to give it a try?
Indeed, except for this one experience. I had the brilliant idea of having a sandwich.
A sandwich?
Yes, I'm hyperactive. So this was a while back, so
this
I thought I could do it.
After the marathon?
No, before.
No, that's a problem.
Absolutely. So I was running and starting to feel ill, and they're announcing,
that's surprising,
Pietro Moro, number of from ESM Luxembourg. And yeah, and you just, you know, wave and smile and keep going. And made it through at the end in a good time as well.
Just because there were 5K.
But absolutely, so preparation is key, I guess.
Yeah,
I
no,
can imagine
yeah.
for a marathon.
And also, like, you know, that's the biggest, two of the biggest pieces of advice I got is, like, make sure you test what you eat.
Okay.
Test it on your trial runs, not on
the day.
Yeah. And the other good piece of advice that I got is, like, cut your toenails really short. And when you think you've cut them short, cut them again.
The toenails?
So you don't lose them.
Ah, wow, yeah, okay, makes sense.
Okay. Well, when you run on the same shoes for 40 kilometers, it's like, it depends on the timing, but it can be between 3, 4, 5 hours.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
So you don't get black toenails or lose them. So that was a good piece of advice.
And we keep going with the pieces of advice, Pietro. We start on our Brussels Unplugged recommendations.
Absolutely, let's go.
We start with our guest, Sabina. Any restaurant, book, or movie, or series that you have watched that you feel to recommend to our listeners?
So I'm a big fan of the Brussels cuisine, or cuisine picture, if you want, because it's not necessarily Brussels cuisine. And I tend to test new places every month. I have a list of saved places in Brussels already for 2025. I have a list of about 15 restaurants that I haven't tried yet.
Oh wow!
So I like what do I like? I like wine bars. So those are one. I mean, I'm doing dry January right now, so that's a bit sad for the next 2 weeks, but it's coming back. And my favorite is Rebel. It's between Plage and Avenue Louise. It's a very kind of 10 people can fit in there. In the winter, in the summer, you have tables outside. But they have really nice kind of local tapas-like cuisine and really nice wines. Also a big fan of Tarzan in Châtelain, because they have natural wines, biodynamic wines, which is my new discovery. Not so new, but about 2 years, and it's really nice, because you can have a bottle of wine and go around the following morning without feeling like hell.
Because it doesn't have all the sulfates and the additives, right? Everything else.
Yeah, and also I like the philosophy of, like, winemakers who make natural wine,
mm-hmm.
because you kind of have to fully rely on nature to, you know, and you have to clean with your own hands, mm-hmm. like the potential grapes that have gone bad and things like that. So I like the philosophy of how the winemakers live in sync with nature as opposed to fighting it. So, developing a taste for the wine, but working on it. But out of that belief in the philosophy, I'll keep doing it.
Great, we know where to go drink after January.
Absolutely, this Friday as well. For me, I discovered a really nice book over the holiday. It's called The Midnight Library.
That's a great book.
You've read it.
Love it.
Don't spoil. I'm not at the end yet. I'm nearly there. But Matt,
not telling you anything.
Okay, lovely. Anyway, it's we can give a little bit of a little abstract of it, right, to our listeners without spoiling it. It's about essentially life and life choices and the different universes and worlds that you walk into just with a choice. And it's a very, very thought-provoking book, I found.
I agree. I loved it. Yeah. I read it in like 10 days. Can't remember, a couple of years back. It came out about
2020, 2021, yeah. Something like that.
It's a great book.
Great. Absolutely. I've been. I'm going to leave you with a couple of TV series recommendations because I think that January and these dark days and gray days are ideal to stay back home on the sofa and we just watch Netflix. And I've been binge watching a couple of TV series. I watched the second season of Squid Game.
Okay.
Which was a big disappointment. Do not expect anything great. If you are a fan of the first season, it seems to me that the second season was just a commercial stretch to reach out to the audience, but there's nothing much better than this first season. A second series I feel like to recommend is called The Black Dove. It's about spies, diplomats and so forth. It's not at the level of Homeland, which is my favorite, but there is a second season that has been already announced, so it's quite okay, it's quite good. And thirdly, just to homage our guest that works with Tech UK, I started, not finished, but I've started the TV series about Churchill and the war.
There you go. There's always a TV series about Churchill and the war.
Yes, and apparently this one seems to be a bit nicer. They have restored old footage, they've colored them, they've restored his own voice. So it's good on a weekend, you know, not to binge watch, because it's like, I don't think it's a series to binge watch, but nonetheless, it seems interesting.
Given the times we live in, I think we can't have enough historical series to binge.
No.
Watch.
exactly. Well, that's wraps it up, Pietro. Sabina, thanks a lot for all the insight.
Thank you for being with us.
Lovely conversation. We are going to go back to our listeners on the 25th of February, as usual, Pietro.
Absolutely.
Next time it's going to be just the two of us. We're going to reflect on this first season of The Brussels Unplugged. We're going to look back at our guests and what we discussed, and we're going to have a chat,
more informal. A nice cold beer as well.
Exactly. Thank you to our listeners for being with us, and see you in a month.
Ciao.